This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. I just read a great book. Saying I read it doesn't totally capture the experience because it's a graphic novel and the artwork is remarkable. The book is called My Favorite Thing is Monsters, and it was written and drawn by my guest Emile Ferris. Set in 1968, it's rendered in the form of a diary sketchbook of a 10-year-old girl named Karen who lives in a gritty Chicago neighborhood. Karen loves horror movies and horror comics and thinks of herself and draws herself as a monster, the Wolfman. She also loves detective comics, and when her upstairs neighbor, Anka, is found shot to death, Karen takes on the role of detective. The police say it's a suicide. Karen thinks it's a murder. In her attempt to find out who did it, she learns the story of Anka's life and the monstrous ways she was treated. Anka was born in 1920 in Berlin, lived with her mother in a brothel, was later sold into another brothel, and then deported to a concentration camp. The review in The New Yorker said, "Some of the images in My Favorite Thing is Monsters could easily compete with pieces hanging in museums and galleries." And the book speaks to the current political climate in chilling ways. There's a horror story behind the book. Ferris wrote and drew it after she was bitten by a mosquito that infected her with West Nile virus, leading to encephalitis and meningitis. That was about 15 years ago when she was 40. It left her paralyzed. Over time, she regained some use of her right hand, enabling her to write and draw again. She's now able to walk with a cane, two canes if she's tired. It's back to the wheelchair when she's very tired. Emile Ferris, welcome to Fresh Air. I absolutely love this book. At the risk of stating the obvious, you got West Nile from a mosquito bite. And mosquitoes are like insect vampires. So when you got bit, did it seem like a horror story come true?
Absolutely. And one of the hallmarks of West Nile virus is that because you get encephalitis and meningitis, there are so many delusions, illusions, and hallucinations that are part of this fever and chills that builds up to your final destination, which is ultimately, in the mind of the virus, death. But for me, it was paralysis and, of course, a rich panoply of remembered delusions and hallucinations.
Can I ask you to describe some of them?
Well, there was a painting in the room that I was in when I was in the fever in the hospital, and I saw characters coming in and out of the painting, which sort of led to a different, not this particular graphic novel, but informed something else I wrote. And I saw an enormous rock. I was shown that. But that was after the Angel of Death came to visit. And the Angel of Death, as I saw it in my fever, was a very big 1940s kind of a gray teal blue filing cabinet. And it was sort of a bureaucrat. And it just came into the room and spoke. One of the drawers slightly opened. And there was this sort of glowing light inside of it. And it said, "Are you in or are you out? We need to know for our records." And I said, I thought of my daughter. And I thought, yeah, I'm in. I got to stay. I got to finish this, because she was only six at the time. And then I saw this enormous rock, and there was something inside of the rock, and it was this gold. And what was said to me is, there's a very hard path for you since you've decided to stay, but there is something beautiful inside of the difficulty, and you're going to have to chip through this rock to get to it. Within a little while, and since I don't really remember how long because I was in an intense fever, somebody came in and he said to me, "The reason we've been coming in and doing things with your feet is that we've been pricking them with needles and you haven't moved at all. And we've done all these tests and we've determined that from a very high vertebrae down, you're paralyzed. And so you're going to try to stand up, but you're not going to be able to walk." He told me all this, but I couldn't respond because I couldn't speak, nor could I use my right hand because the right side was more paralyzed than the left.
That sounds like the worst nightmare ever, and it was actually happening. I mean, to be locked in like that and kind of trapped with your hallucinations and then have reality tell you, and you'll never walk again, which turned out to not be true, but still, that's what they told you. That's what the doctor told you in real life.
Yeah.
I just can't imagine, you know, what's Welcome to my horrible.
I was really fortunate. Yeah. I was fortunate. I had this wonderful woman, Margaret Brabham, who was a friend of mine, and she had helped me make the party at which I was bitten. And she stayed for 7 days in the hospital.
Wait, you were bitten at your own party?
I was bitten at my own birthday party.
And what were your first symptoms?
They were intense fever followed by chills, and then I slept for days and days, and I was completely unaware of anything during that time. My daughter had a terrible time because she was only 6 years old, and she kept coming into the room and saying, "Mom, I think you're dying. I really do. You've been asleep for days, and I'm just watching a lot of television." And I said, "Well, are you eating?" And she said, "Yes, we have carrots." You know, so it was pretty bad. It was really bad. I was completely unaware of anything. I was totally out of it.
Who was she with?
She was with me. And finally, then I...
You mean you were at home during this?
I was at home, and I became completely delusional with the encephalitis and meningitis.
Oh, I assumed you were in the hospital by this point.
No, I did not go into the hospital for some time. I kept kind of rallying and taking her to camp and then going through a period of a day or 2 days where I was sleeping. And she was watching an awful lot of television. And it's pretty bad.
Gosh.
Yeah. And I remember when it was.
That doesn't seem fair at all.
Well, you know, it was the strangest thing because, Terry, I can honestly tell you this book wouldn't exist if I hadn't been bitten. The experience really coalesced my ferocity around regaining the ability to draw and walk and live and create. It became clear to me that it was much more important to be generous and to do the best that I could and give something to the world, that it is possible to leave this place without giving anything. And I didn't want that to be my trajectory.
Okay, so you get bitten. You have these horrible, like, hallucinations, really frightening ones. The doctor tells you you're paralyzed. And then as you start to regain some movement in your hand and teach yourself to draw again, you know, you eventually start drawing this book, My Favorite Thing is Monsters. So I just keep thinking of all the places in your imagination that you could go to when you couldn't walk and you were trapped all day in a chair, that you decide to go to the world of horror, to the world of horror movies and horror comics, and as we'll talk about a little later, to the story of the Holocaust as told by a Holocaust survivor. It's like, why would you want to go to such dark places in your imagination when the reality was so dark? Maybe that is why.
Well, you know, there's this thing in art, there's the chiaroscuro, there's the way that light shows in darkness, and it is extremely beautiful. And I think it essentializes the experience of being human, to see light in darkness. It is so much more beautiful in that place. And for me, the moments of beauty, you know, when I duct taped a quill pen to my hand and, you know, I'm shaking, knocking the bottles of ink, and my daughter steadies my hand and helps me put the quill down in. And then, you know, she's with me. She's standing beside the drafting table and I'm drawing. And then I draw the wheelchair, and I say, "Could you draw me?" I'm thinking she's going to draw me sitting in the wheelchair, but she draws me standing up out of it. And she says, "Mama, I know that they told you you're not going to walk again, but I really believe you will." And it's in those moments when everything seems so dark that the most beautiful things happen, you know, and that was one of them. And I have that drawing as actually part of an article that I wrote about the experience. And it was in Chicago Magazine, so people can see that drawing that we did together. And there were all kinds of special things that she embedded in the drawing for me that I could look at. You know, there were golden boxes of love floating over my head, and there was just all this beauty in it. And so, yes, horror and the Holocaust, these are some of the darkest points in our existence as human beings. But there's still enormous courage and tremendous love that's possible to be seen in that great darkness. So
the book is great. I will add, your daughter sounds wonderful. So
she is wonderful. Yes, she really is.
So in your book, the main character, the girl who's at the center of the story, she identifies as a wolfman. She just sees herself as the wolfman. And other times she sees herself as a private eye and has like a trench coat and a hat, like the classic private eyes. Is this you? Have you identified with the supernatural monsters more than with their victims?
Very definitely. I always did. I always loved them. I always had a tremendous amount of sympathy for them. I always felt like they were kind of heroic because they were facing something. You know, becoming a monster sometimes isn't a choice that you have. And everyone is somebody's monster. You know, we're all the other in one way or another. And I felt like, especially the werewolf in the 1941 movie, he had enormous courage in a way because he faced what he was. And it was terrifying to him to realize that the tracks that came into his posh bedroom led to his own feet. And I think in our lives, we all have that moment, many of us do anyway, that we realize that those tracks come to our feet, that we are culpable, and we are not necessarily anything less than monstrous in the ways that we are.
Well, with the Wolfman, it's not under his control.
Right. And I don't think it's really, I'm not sure that any monster chooses monsterhood. But I would have if I was, when I was a kid, I was definitely looking for that bite. You know, I was just like, I'd go out in the alley. I'll take the garbage out. Hopeful, you know, really hopeful. I've got some bad scabs here. And I'm sure that any monster could smell this blood. So, you know, I was really hoping for that bite. And then, of course, I did ultimately get it, right, Terry?
Yeah, so. You sure did. No, I know you had very severe scoliosis when you were younger and you were in a body cast for a few years. Did you feel...
Well, for 9 months, actually.
For 9 months, okay.
Yeah,
did you
yeah.
feel disfigured and monstrous as a result of that?
Well, I was. I was born with a pretty severe scoliosis. Did not walk until I was 2.5, almost 3 years old. So I had a severe spinal curvature, which made me look different, which made me walk different. I was treated very well, though. I will say that I had amazing care given to me. I lived in urban areas where people were all different, and I was protected, and I was loved very much the way Karen is by Franklin. And I learned how to tell stories because of it.
So did you especially feel like the Wolfman when you're going through puberty and literally growing new hair? Do you know what I mean? And
my gosh.
Having your body change.
Well, you know, I'm part a lot of different ethnicities that produce hair. So hair was always, you know, definitely a part of my life. And, you know, I mean, I remember when my brother was born and we sort of just like parted the hair to see what he looked like, you know. And so we're kind of like that. And yeah.
So your character says that she'll be one of the undead when she grows up, which means she won't have to fear death. Did you have
exactly.
thoughts like that?
Well, yes, actually, and this is maybe it's part of the book and I never considered it, but when I was about 8 years old, they didn't have a surgery for what I had. And
for the scoliosis?
Exactly. And I was told that I would not live past 30, that my spine was running into my heart and that it would eventually do that and that I would not survive. So although that seems like a fairly long life, my mother was 30 or around there at the time. So I thought, well, I will only live as long as my very young, beautiful mother, and so I'm going to die. And, you know, it was clear to me that that was a possibility. So I think the idea of escaping into the undead was much more appealing to me at that point. Yeah.
Emile Ferris is the author of the new graphic novel, My Favorite Thing is Monsters. We'll be back after a break, and Maureen Corrigan will review a new novel that's a semi-satire about identity politics on college campuses. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross, back with Emile Ferris, author of the new graphic novel, My Favorite Thing is Monsters. The book takes the form of a 10-year-old girl's sketchbook and journal. The girl, Karen, loves classic monster movies and monster comics and sees herself as a werewolf. She also encounters monstrous things in her own life, including the story of how her upstairs neighbor survived the Holocaust. Karen and her creator, Emile Ferris, have a lot in common, including a love of monsters and of art. Ferris depicts Karen going to museums captivated by the paintings, classic paintings which Ferris draws versions of in the book. Before we get back to the interview, I want to let parents know that we'll soon be getting into some disturbing subjects that might not be appropriate for young children. You reproduce some famous paintings in your book. So you do like your sketches of the paintings. One of the paintings you do is a very famous one called The Nightmare from 1781 by Henry Fuseli. Mm-hmm. And this has got kind of like classic depiction of a nightmare. A woman is lying on a bed wearing a very kind of like flimsy draped nightgown, and a demon is sitting on her chest, and the demon represents the nightmare that's basically paralyzing her. And her head is kind of falling off the bed, and the arms are kind of thrown back. And so in your book, the girl's brother says that that painting is very sexy. And she says, considering the whole arithmetic of boobs and monsters equal horror, I guess he's probably right. She doesn't really yet understand why necessarily.
Well, yeah. And her mother is got breast cancer. So there is that element of it as well. And, you know, she's playing with the idea of becoming a woman. And what a fearful thing in the world.
And I want to read part of her notebook that she keeps. She says, "Dear notebook, I'll tell you straight. In my opinion, the best horror magazine covers are the ones where the lady's boobs aren't spilling out as she's getting attacked by a monster. Those covers give me something worse than the creeps. I think the boob covers send a secret message that it's very dangerous to have breasts. And considering what Mama's going through, maybe the magazines know stuff that we don't."
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I think it's a strange confluence of things that breasts are such a central focus in our culture, and they're so under attack in terms of disease. So, you know, that was something I always wondered about, and something I think she does too.
In your book, My Favorite Thing is Monsters, the second story in this, the second main story, is a flashback story. And it's the story of the upstairs neighbor who's a Holocaust survivor and one day is found dead in her bed, shot to death. And this happens right upstairs from where the little girl lives. And she wants to find out, like, was this a murder? And if so, who killed her? She uses all of her, like, detective skills to try to understand that. And so, you know, this beautiful woman who was the neighbor upstairs, like she grew up in Nazi Germany. Her mother was broke and basically lived in a brothel with the girl. And the mother was mean. She put out cigarettes on the girl's hand. And then the girl was sold to a brothel and she was forced into basically sexual slavery and then sent to a concentration camp. And it's just like a horrible set of circumstances. Why did you choose to use the Holocaust to get at the kind of, like, violence and sexual brutality?
I live not very far away from where a woman who happened to be wearing a hijab was murdered under the L tracks. And, you know, it became clear to me, this was years before I wrote the book, it became clear to me that we're looking at a change in our society where we're allowing ourselves to vilify a group of people and to decide that violence towards them is acceptable. And, you know, most people, I think, unfortunately, I really felt this was much more true before now, most people would not feel that way. They would be protective around the Holocaust as an event that, you know, innocent people, a whole world of innocent, decent human beings were wiped away from the earth and we lost them all. And they were, you know, scarred, and those that survived at tremendous cost. So, you know, I think when I reflect on that kind of cruelty being done from human to human, I'm hoping that people begin to see that this is where, that if we are not careful about how we think and what we allow ourselves to do, we will be back in a situation where we're perpetrating more horror. And I don't think that, I don't think people are reasoning that out as fully as I wish they were. So I grew up in an area of Chicago, Rogers Park, where there were a lot of Holocaust survivors. Some of them were the mothers of my friends. And, you know, I saw those numbers.
The tattooed numbers.
Yes, their sleeves would come up a little bit, and I would see the numbers tattooed there. And I understood then immediately the profound sorrow, this reservoir of deep sorrow that I felt, that I intuited in them. And so it was not a stretch. I had people telling me their stories at bus stops. I guess I'm the kind of person that people do that with, or maybe they just were so rife with stories. And I visited old folks' homes, And I collected these stories, and that's what Anka's story is based on.
As a child, you collected those stories?
I did. People opened up to me, and they told me about what they had experienced. And as a child, I thought it was almost impossible that it was true. And then I began researching as I got older, and I found out that everything they told me had a basis and was true. And it was astounding, you know, that people had survived. In recent memory, really, things that are so terrible, we can barely believe them.
I wonder if they told you stories that they would never tell their own children.
I think that's true. I think that I was this person that seemed sympathetic and they could just let things go. And they let things go between us. Yeah, I think you're probably right about that.
What did you do as a child trying to, you know, like process all this ugliness?
I think I knew that it was part and parcel of the world. I think I felt every year that I approached 30, believing that I wasn't going to survive, I think I felt like I would understand these things and I was here to do that. I mean, I think that being told that you have a limited amount of time, and the truth is we all have a limited amount of time, but we don't allow ourselves to know that, right? But I think that being very aware of death allows you to be extremely intentional about being alive and knowing that you might have a purpose here. And I allowed that purpose to be the knowledge, the knowing, the understanding, the looking into somebody's eyes as they told me things that they probably would not have told their children. And for a while, I thought maybe being a repository of these truths, these stories, was the only intention I had. But this book sort of reflects those back out into the world.
So what are the things that scare you now? Like, you've been through so much, you've survived so much, you love horror movies and horror comics. So what frightens you?
Well, I had an experience last night. I guess I can talk about it. I was lying in bed and I felt somebody put their hand on my arm. And I didn't know if I was almost asleep. I didn't know if there wasn't anyone there putting their hand on my arm. And I kind of said to myself, well, maybe it was a ancestor. Maybe it was somebody giving me courage because I knew I was coming here to talk to you. That kind of thing, you know, I get afraid of the dark if I am in a great deal of dark. And I have to move around inside of that fear and say, but there is a chance that something I need to talk to me will talk to me from the dark. So I have to stay at least gripping myself enough to be prepared for that communication, which has happened. You know, I've had things in the darkness speak to me, not audibly, but certainly in my soul. And they've enriched the book. So I'm not sure if they're on my team or not, but they have helped. I'm not a big fan of heights, and I'm not really super excited about water, like being over big bodies of water. I have a feeling I've drowned like 14 times in past lives. I mean it. I know that sounds crazy, but I think I've really just like, it might, like if I have a past life regression, I think it's just going to be like scenes of me going under and under. I'm a cat, I'm a woman, I'm a Roman soldier. I just keep drowning. Yeah.
So I think it's interesting that you're afraid of the dark because you identify with monsters, but you're afraid of the dark.
Oh, sure. I do not try to watch horror movies and then be alone. You know, I mean, I'm not above fear.
Emil Ferris, thank you so much for talking with us. I so totally enjoyed it, and congratulations on the book.
Terry, thank you.
Emil Ferris is the author of the new graphic novel, My Favorite Thing is Monsters. Our book critic, Maureen Corrigan, has a review of the new novel, The Devil and Webster, by Jean Homf Korelitz. It surveys student life at a New England college in turmoil. Korelitz's 2009 novel, Admission, which was adapted into a movie starring Tina Fey, took readers on an inside tour of the college admissions process at Princeton. Here's Maureen's review of The Devil and Webster.
A few days ago, one of my students asked me what I was reading, so I told her about Jean Homf Korelitz's new novel called The Devil and Webster. My student's eyes got wider as I finished lightly summarizing the plot, and she said, with some concern about Korelitz, I hope she's ready for all the angry tweets and emails. Yeah, I think she probably is. Korelitz's new novel is a smart semi-satire about the reign of identity politics on college campuses today. That in itself is a tricky subject for a white novelist to tackle, unless she or he is a far-right conservative, which Korelitz is not. But then Corlitz makes matters even more complicated. Her heroine is a Jewish feminist college president named Naomi Roth. Facing off against her are an African-American professor and a Palestinian undergraduate. These two men turn out to be the most duplicitous characters in the story. You see why my students' eyes widened at what sounds like a deliberately provocative setup. Recently, the novelist Lionel Shriver stirred up a lot of criticism on the left by publicly denouncing what she called tippy-toe fiction, constrained by identity politics. Corlitz is not tippy-toeing here. Rather, she's asserting the novelist's right to imagine a story that's messier than a homily, and characters who are more nuanced than mere emblems. Corlitz's setting is the fictional Webster College. Webster is an elite liberal arts college in the mode of Amherst or Williams. It used to be a bastion of old boys and old money, but it remade itself in the 1970s. Now Webster boasts a much more diverse student body, along with a dining hall that serves culturally sensitive cuisine of all nations and a college portfolio divested of all trace elements of nuclear energy and diamond dust. And Webster has its first female president in Naomi Roth. Naomi is our moral center, and she couldn't be more likable. A single mother, astute and beleaguered, wild-haired, and a tad frumpy. She still harbors a lingering case of imposter syndrome under her proper Eileen Fisher outfits. When the story begins, Naomi has become aware of a growing band of students, her own daughter among them, camped out around the stump, the epicenter of campus and the traditional gathering place for protests. But this group of protesters is maddeningly closed-mouthed, refusing to meet with the administration to discuss their grievances. At one point, Naomi talks with her friend Francine, the director of admissions at Webster, and Francine shrewdly characterizes this new mutation of campus protest in the internet age. Naomi says, "My door's been open for months. What kind of protest declines dialogue with its opponent?" "A modern one," Francine said dryly. "These kids are not like we were. Interaction across the battle lines isn't what they're after. They want to represent something to their peers more than they want to gain respect from their opponents." "Or accomplish anything," Naomi said, rolling her eyes. "Oh," said Francine, "they're accomplishing plenty. They're compiling influence, gaining likes, getting retweeted. That's part of it," Francine replied. "No point denying it." One of the causes of the protest turns out to be the fact that a popular anthropology professor has been denied tenure. Because he's African American, students accuse Webster of institutional racism. Naomi and the tenure committee have to remain silent for legal reasons, even though they know that the professor is guilty of something more damning than suspiciously high "rate my professor" scores, complimenting his astronomically inflated grades. When a young student, a Palestinian refugee named Omar Khayyal, emerges as the professor's most eloquent defender, the situation becomes so heated, Naomi has real cause to fear that she'll be ousted from the presidency of Webster. The Devil and Webster is wittily on target about, among other things, social class and privilege, silencing, old school feminist ambivalence about power, and Corlitz's home subject, the insanity of the college admissions process. But its central dilemma, whether we can form a cosmopolitan community where we affirm our individual identities yet remain connected to one another, is, in realistic fashion, no closer to being resolved by the time we get to the end of the book.
Maureen Carrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Devil and Webster by Jean Homf Corlitz. Coming up, the rise of for-profit colleges. We hear from sociologist Tressie McMillan Cottom. She worked as an enrollment officer at two for-profit colleges. She quit after realizing her job required selling students an education they could not afford. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. For-profit colleges are back in the news. The industry had faced federal and state investigations for the ways they recruited students, especially people of color and women, people who were struggling financially, and convinced them to enroll and sign up for federal student loans they'd be unlikely to be able to pay off. At the height of the recession, for-profit colleges accounted for nearly half of student loan defaults. The Obama administration sued one major for-profit college for deceptive advertising, sued another for predatory lending, and challenged the status of the largest accreditor of for-profit colleges. The Trump administration has a more favorable view of the sector. My guest, Tressie McMillan Cottom, is the author of a new book about for-profit colleges called Lower Ed. She worked as an enrollment officer for two for-profits at opposite ends of the spectrum, a cosmetology career school and a large college that offered associates, bachelor's, and graduate degrees. She left after fearing that instead of helping the students she recruited to improve their financial future, she was leaving them with large student loan debt they'd never earn enough to repay. When she left the for-profit college sector, she returned to college, completed her BA, and went on to earn her PhD from Emory University. Her dissertation was a study of for-profit colleges. Cottom is now an assistant professor of sociology at Virginia Commonwealth University. Tressie McMillan Cottom, welcome to Fresh Air. So describe the kind of new for-profit colleges that you write about. What separates them from other colleges?
New for-profit colleges are really as much about where our society is right now as it is about the schools themselves. For-profit colleges are not new. They have existed for almost as long as higher education has existed in the United States. But there was a sense that for-profit colleges had increased their dominance. And I was trying to figure out why that sense existed and if it was related to fact. And what I find, like others have found, is that it is. While for-profit colleges have existed for a long time, we have not always had corporate for-profit colleges. Now, for-profit colleges, starting around the mid-1990s, are no longer owned by like mom-and-pop local chains. Increasingly, they were owned by shareholder corporations. So they had become a financial vehicle. Because they are a financial vehicle, the way they operate and their relationship to profit and education had shifted. Now, the questions that come out of that is,
but can
well,
I stop you a
matter?
Second? So you're saying mm-hmm. that a lot of for-profit colleges now exist to make a profit and that's their priority over education?
Correct. And not just, they've always existed to make a profit. It's the scale of profit that is quite distinct. A corporate shareholder college has to not just make a profit at the end of the year, but it needs to make a profit quarter over quarter. And over the long term, there needs to be substantial growth. That's just what a corporation is designed to do.
So what function are the for-profits supposed to serve within the larger world of mm-hmm. educational institutions?
Now, that for me was sort of the big question, because if they've existed for a long time and if millions of people go to them and if we subsidize them to the tune of $13 to $14 billion a year, then they must be serving a purpose. In higher education, the purpose they serve is sort of twofold. First, they provide some training in professions that traditional not-for-profit colleges either can't provide or it would be too expensive for them to provide. So that's things like a certificate in auto mechanics or a certificate in cosmetology, those types of regulated professions that don't require a full degree but do require some formal training. Well, it's kind of expensive, actually, to offer those programs at scale because they're so hands-on. You really fundamentally have to build, usually, a laboratory for the students to get their applied experience. Most not-for-profit colleges have gotten out of that business. The second purpose they find was a little less obvious and less discussed sort of in the public discourse, and that is they are serving, for-profit colleges are serving a role in credentialing or giving a degree or credential to workers who are increasingly unemployed or underemployed in the new economy. So as workers need to constantly get training to stay employable in the labor market, not-for-profit higher education isn't really set up for that. We're set up for a one-and-done scenario. You come, you get the credential that's going to, you know, send you off into life to improve your life chances, and ideally, you never come back to us. Well, for-profit colleges are set up for students to constantly come back and get the new credential so that they can stay employed.
So you're suggesting that in the world we live in now, in a lot of professions, you have to keep going back and get further training, a further accreditation, and that it's often the for-profit colleges that provide that.
That's right. For-profit colleges, in many ways, are providing the job training that employers once did but no longer do.
So you're suggesting now that you used to be able to get that on the job, but now you have to pay for it.
Correct.
And is tuition the right word? What do you have to pay at most of the for-profit colleges?
Tuition is the right word. On average, whatever the degree is, whether it's in a certificate or it is an associate's degree, a bachelor's degree, or a master's degree, at every level of credential, for-profit colleges on average are about 30% to 40% more expensive than the same credential in the same program at a not-for-profit public institution.
Why is that?
So there are a couple of reasons why for-profit colleges would be more expensive. The first is all that stuff that we critique traditional colleges for doing, having dorms, having community space because they have large campuses. For-profit colleges don't have that. So they say that they're more cost-effective. But the flip side of that is the only way they have to generate revenue or profit is from tuition. So if you're a financialized organization or a corporate shareholder-owned for-profit college that relies on tuition growth to generate your profit, the only way you can do that is to keep increasing costs. So they tend to peg the tuition costs to the fully allowable amount that students are allowed to borrow from the federal student aid program.
So this creates a situation where it's typically people who don't have a large income, often people who are people of color, single working parents, mm-hmm. who end up in these schools, but they cost a lot of money. So you have people, mm-hmm. Without a lot of income, paying mm-hmm. really large fees for tuition. So what kind of situation does that create?
The situation that creates is that because of how we finance higher education in this country, because we rely so much on student loans that are what we call means tested, meaning you can qualify for more money the less money you have. Well, we designed it that way so that those with the least amount of resources could increase their educational choices and options because they could borrow more. Well, the problem in the for-profit college sector is that means that the poor students can borrow the most. Well, that creates an incentive for for-profit colleges to recruit students who will qualify for the maximum amount of student aid. Well, those happen to be the poorest among us. And because of how our society is set up, the poorest among us tend to be women and people of color. So the indirect effect of this is that women, especially women of color, are the most vulnerable to the incentives that have been set in place for revenue and profit taking among for-profit colleges.
Do a lot of people end up dropping out and being in debt?
Yes. About 30% to 40% of the students who enroll in a for-profit college will complete. To be fair, poor students especially have really difficult completion statistics no matter where they go to school. Some of that is about how complicated we know people's lives are when they don't have a lot of money, right? When you have to stop in and out because you have daycare needs or your work schedule changes, those kinds of things. The question I ask is, yes, but is the risk worth it? In public higher education, the risk tends to be worth it when students drop out for a couple of reasons. The first being they drop out with less debt. So when their lives become a little less complicated and they want to return to school, they have easier access coming back because they haven't borrowed so much. The other thing that happens is that if you drop out of a traditional not-for-profit college, the credits you have earned tend to be more portable. Other schools accept them. So when your life becomes a little less complicated and you want to go back to school, you have more options if you went to a traditional not-for-profit college. What we see in the for-profit college sector is those students drop out with more debt, making it harder for them to return, especially if they have problems repaying that debt while they are out of school. But when they do return, it is easier for them to return to another for-profit college because those credits earned in a for-profit college are not as portable. So in many ways, what happens is that the students in the for-profit college sector are really cycling in and out and through the for-profit college sector, which we know is more expensive, where they will incur more debt, and where they have lower outcomes when they graduate, if they ever do graduate.
So these colleges are supposed to be the education that offers people a path to a better job, a better life, mm-hmm. a higher status.
Right.
But if you end up having to default on a loan, mm-hmm. or if you end up being, you know, in debt because of a loan, what mm-hmm. happens?
Your options for education are pretty much foreclosed upon. Debt has made our choice of higher education options far riskier than they were 20 or 30 years ago. And in the for-profit college sector, that's especially acute because those students are more likely to be poor or low income or sort of dancing along the line of poverty, as I say it, right? Even if they're not poor at the moment, they have a lot of risk factors for dropping below the poverty line. Because of that, for-profit colleges really aren't set up to transform these students' lives in the way that we think higher education is supposed to do. And so, for me, the consequence of that is this system that we've come to rely on to increase access to higher education to the most vulnerable among us really only compounds their poverty and their risk factors. Well, that's the exact opposite of what higher education is supposed to do.
So you have a lot of concerns now about the value of a diploma from an institution like the technical college where you worked as an enrollment officer. Did mm-hmm. you have those kinds of questions at the time?
Oh, goodness, no. In many ways, when I worked at the technical school and at the cosmetology school, I was a lot like the students who were coming to see me in that I did not know what a for-profit college was. We still find that most students do not know what a for-profit college is. There's no reason to assume then that I would question things like, oh, does this school work differently than a traditional college? A traditional college like the one I myself had attended. I just didn't think in those terms. I did, however, have feelings about how the school operated, what some of the messages were that we were getting from the management and the executive director of the school that made me second guess whether or not we were counseling prospective students to make the best educational choice for them, even if that educational choice meant not attending our school, or if we were selling them on our school and hoping that they would not pay attention to the ways that it may not be a good fit for them. What I ended up deciding was that we weren't counseling, because counseling suggests that we will help you make the best choice even if we don't benefit from your choice. That instead, we were selling people. And when you sell someone, your job isn't to give them more choices, but to give them fewer choices. And because of that, I started to question, well, why do we operate that way? And I wouldn't figure out until much later when I was a sociologist why that might be.
What were your concerns about whether a student could afford the tuition or not?
Mm-hmm. Sitting with prospective students when they sat in their first financial aid meeting, when the financial aid person would lay out all of their financial options, was some of the first times I started to think really critically about what the process was at the technical school. So one example is that students would often have a balance left over. So even after they'd borrowed the maximum amount that they could borrow from federal student aid and had gotten any grants that they may have qualified for, some students would have a balance left over. And it's when they had that balance, they had some unmet need, that some of those differences or some of the problems really started to emerge for me. Because the options that the technical school mostly gave them were options that were just going to make them much more likely to take on debt that they couldn't afford. So the first option we would usually offer was a payment plan, right? A monthly payment plan to pay off the balance. Well, if that payment plan and the balance gave you something like a $300 to $400 a month payment while you were in school, and you were already probably attending the school because you didn't have a lot of income, that was not feasible for most of the students at the technical school. So the next option we would offer is, do you know anyone in your family who could co-sign on either a parental loan or a private student loan? And well, those are a problem because they don't offer any of the protections that have made the student loans that students get easier to manage, right? So low interest loans with very forgiving repayment terms, you don't have that in the private student loan market. When I saw relatively poor and low income students deciding to take on both student loan debt and private student loan debt, and inviting in their family members to co-sign on additional loans, so sort of spreading their risk around into their social networks so that they could afford this education, I really started to ask whether they could ever afford it at all. Should they have been there if they had to go through all of those steps to afford the tuition?
But at the moment, everybody might have felt really good about it. Mm-hmm. I don't necessarily mean you, but I mean the student, the person co-signing for the loan, because we believe in education. I mean, education,
right.
It's your ticket to social mm-hmm. mobility, to professional advancement, to income.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, we believe in the mm-hmm. value of education, as we should.
Yes, we do. You know, in the book, I call this the education gospel, borrowing from other people who have used this term. And it's this idea that, yes, education is foundational to the narrative of social mobility in this country. And probably nothing is more American than the idea that through hard work, right, everybody can separate themselves from the circumstances of their birth. Through achievement and hard work, we can all get ahead. And if the way we are telling people in the new economy that the single way you can get ahead is by getting all the education you can, well, people are listening to that. People actually believe in that. Even poor people who have very little reason to believe in it because they've gone to relatively poor K-12 schools and had negative experiences. Over and over again, I heard people espousing their faith in education. And that is a good thing. We want people to believe in the development of themselves. We want them to believe in self-actualization. These things are really important human values. The problem is when our education gospel doesn't make a distinction between good education and risky education. And here in that gap is where for-profit colleges flourish. They flourish in the gap between what our education gospel says we should do and what our language says there's no such thing as. If we say there's no such thing as bad school, it makes a job like the one I once had at the technical school much easier to do. It is easy to sell people when they don't have any language to understand the idea that school could actually leave them worse off than when they started.
Tracy McMillan Cotton, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me, Terry.
Tracy McMillan Cotton is the author of the new book, Lower Ed. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Heidi Simon. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Teresa Madden, Mood Zaidi, and Thea Chaloner. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. I'm Terry Gross.